the doctor. You may think it is not important, but we cannot take such a risk.
I told you before, Brudnoy said, we are not Trojan horses, nor Frankenstein monsters.
How do you know? The doctor shot back.
You may have been infected without your knowledge.
Nonsense, Joanna spat.
That is a risk we will not take, the doctor repeated firmly. Do you honestly believe that anyone at Moonbase would inject us with nanobugs that would be dangerous to Earth? Why would they do something like that? What possible reason could there be?
The doctor folded his hands over his middle again.
Mrs. Brudnoy, the chances of such an event are minuscule, I admit, but the consequences of such an event, no matter how unlikely it may be, would be catastrophic.
Joanna looked at Brudnoy, who shrugged helplessly.
Those are my orders, the doctor said. You are to be held here until the results of your blood tests come in.
Where are the tests being done? Joanna asked.
There are very few facilities with the necessary equipment and personnel who are capable of performing such tests.
Of course, said Brudnoy. You've closed all the nanotechnology facilities.
Where are the tests being done? Joanna insisted.
It is very difficult to analyze blood samples for nanomachines.
Where?
The doctor hesitated, then said,
At the University of Tokyo.
At a lab funded by Yamagata Corporation, I imagine, Brudnoy said. Joanna was too furious to speak.
Day 7. This is Edie Elgin speaking to you from Moonbase.
Edith smiled into the minicam being held by one of the technicians from the defunct Lunar University. Doug Stavanger stood beside the camera woman, smiling encouragement to Edith. She looked bright and beautiful in a close-fitting sheath of cardinal red. Doug had appropriated his mother's wardrobe, the most extensive in Moonbase, hoping that she would understand and not be too angry when she found out. Edith had to do some fast alterations, and now she prayed that the dress would hold together without popping one of her hastily sewn seams.
"Behind me you can see Moonbase's extensive farm," she went on, thinking that maybe a popped seam would improve her ratings. If the shit-faced suits back in Atlanta put her report on the network at all. "More than 500 acres have been carved out of the lunar rock," she said, reading the script she and Doug Stavanger had put together. The words appeared on the flat display screen attached to the minicam just above its lens.
"Here, deep underground, the agricultural specialists of Moonbase grow the food that feeds the 2,476 men and women who live at Moonbase. This corner of the farm," she started walking toward a row of dwarf trees, "is the citrus arbor, where fresh oranges, grapefruit, lemons, and limes are growing."
Edith described the hydroponics trays, bending down to show how the plant roots reached down not into soil, but into liquid nutrients that were carefully matched to each plant's needs. She walked down one of the long rows, pointing out soybeans, legumes, grains, and leafy vegetables.
"Over in that enclosed area," she pointed, "biologists are experimenting with growing plants in an atmosphere that is higher in carbon dioxide than normal. The scientists need to wear breathing masks to work in there."
Edith explained the full-spectrum lighting strips that ran along the farm's high ceiling.
"This artificial sunlight is on 24 hours a day. Moonbase's farm never knows night, and its crop yield is more than 5 times the yield from a similar acreage on Earth."
She showed the flowerbed that Lev Brudnoy had started years ago in lunar soil, and the pens of rabbits and chickens that provided Moonbase's meat. She did not mention the need for nitrogen, which had been imported from Earth, but now would have to be mined from asteroids orbiting near the Earth-Moon system, just as the carbon for building the Diamond Clipper ships was mined.
"Before the current crisis erupted," Edith went on, walking smoothly to an area where two large titanium tanks stood empty, with holes where piping should be attached, "this area was going to be used for an experimental aquaculture section. The idea was to use some of Moonbase's precious water to grow fish, frogs, and alga. Aquaculture can yield more protein per input of energy than even Moonbase's advanced hydroponic farming can, and the water can be recycled almost completely. Her smile faded. Her face grew serious. Unfortunately, the aquaculture project has been put on hold while Moonbase's leaders and the political leadership of the United Nations discuss independence for Moonbase. The camera panned slowly across the farm's rows of hydroponics tanks as Edith continued, Moonbase can feed itself. Even though no spacecraft has been allowed to land here for a week, except for the peacekeeper troops who attempted to seize Moonbase, the men and women of this community on the moon are self-sufficient. The question before the world's leaders now is, will Moonbase's determination to be free be allowed to flower into true independence? The camera stopped on Brudnoy's little flower bed. This is Edie Elgin at Moonbase. We're out, said the camera woman, lowering the minicam and its awkward prompter screen. Good work, Doug said, reaching out to shake Edith's hand. And I didn't mention nanomachines once, did I? Edith said, grinning back at him. You did a great job, Doug said. Edith's grin faded. Now I've got to get the suits to run the damn thing. Still clutching her hand, Doug started toward the airtight hatch that led out of the farm. I've got an idea about that.
Oh?
You talk to Atlanta. I'm going to talk to Kiribati. Tamara Bonai was on the rooftop of the Tarawa Kiribati Hotel and Casino when Doug's call came through. As chairwoman of the board of the Kiribati Corporation, her responsibilities to her people were many and weighty. She knew that the Americans and Europeans regarded her people as childish islanders and regarded her as little more than a figurehead, an attractive front for the real power behind the corporation, Masterson Aerospace and its board chairman, Ibrahim al-Rashid. Until the Moonbase crisis rose up like a sudden typhoon, Bonai had been content to be regarded as a figurehead. Kiribati Corporation was making good profits from its ownership of Moonbase, where the diamond clipper ships were manufactured for sale all over the world, and from its hotels and casinos scattered across a dozen islands in the broad Pacific. A strange combination, nano-manufacturing on the moon and resort hotels on tropical islands, but no stranger than other corporations that took their profits wherever they could find them. Her father had bequeathed the corporate responsibilities to her. The old man had spent as many years as he could stand behind a desk. Finally, he had declared his early retirement and gone off to fish and play with his grandchildren. Tamara, the youngest of his five daughters and the only one still unmarried, inherited his desk. With it came gradually building pressure from the United Nations to force Kiribati to sign the Nanotech Treaty. Knowing that it would mean the death of Moonbase, Bonai resisted as long as she could, looking to Masterson and the other international corporations for help. They gave none. She was especially surprised, even hurt, that Rashid stayed aloof from the struggle with the UN. There were raging arguments in the Masterson Corporation board of directors. Joanna Brudnoy fought for Moonbase's survival, but Rashid insisted that the Nanotech Treaty was unavoidable. Sooner or later, they would have to obey it. Now, Moonbase had defied Foray and the peacekeepers. They had declared their independence, a move that Bonai supported with all her heart. Is it because of Doug that I want Moonbase to win? She asked herself. She had never seen Douglas Stavanger in the flesh. They had never been closer than the moon's distance since they'd first met. Their only contact had been through video phones or virtual reality links, yet she felt that Doug was important to her. She could fall in love with him someday. She sat at a table near the railing that edged the roof and looked out at the sparkling ocean and the surf breaking on the reef beyond the island's white sand beach. One of the hotel's small army of assistant managers brought a phone to her and placed it softly on the table. Mr. Stavanger is calling from Moonbase, the young man said. Bonai thanked him and activated the phone with the touch of a manicured finger. Doug's earnest, handsome face filled the tiny screen as she worked the receiver plug into her right ear. Tamara, did you look at the video we beamed down to you a couple of hours ago? Doug asked immediately.
Yes. The peacekeeper officer killed himself, didn't he?
She glanced at the ocean again as she waited for his response, thinking that he never called except on business. We have no personal relationship, she told herself. It's never even entered his mind. Global News Network is having difficulty deciding whether they want to air it or not.